Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Jeff Freeman, President and CEO of the American Gaming Association. Jeff Freeman, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Bob, Richard, good to be with you.
Is it fair to say that the American Gaming Association is the chief lobbying organization for gaming in the United States? If not, please correct my definition.
Well, we certainly aspire to be, and I think we're achieving that goal. We represent most of the commercial gaming industry that you see here in the United States. We represent the supplier industry, and we also represent a big slice of the tribal gaming industry as well. We're very much focused on Washington and policies here in Washington that affect the gaming industry, but we're also increasingly engaged in the states where we can be a resource and try to ensure a greater degree of consistency in gaming policy from one state to the next.
All right. The first area we want to talk about today is sports gaming. Currently, there's a 25-year-old law called PASPA, which allows sports betting in Nevada and a very few other places. There's now a political climate to eliminate PASPA and allow sports betting in more states. Now, the AGA has been very active on this issue. You've been tweeting right and left on it. So where do you think it's going to go from here?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have to acknowledge that this 1992 law has been an utter failure. Over the course of the 25 years that this law has been put in place, millions of Americans have literally wagered trillions of dollars on sports. They're doing it not in the legal environment in Nevada, unfortunately, but 97% of it is taking place illegally with corner bookies, with illegal offshore operators. That's where the money's going. And the only people today that can't provide a well-run, effective sports betting service are the regulated gaming companies that everyone knows in Nevada and elsewhere. So we've got this law that's a failure. It begs the question, do we want to continue to put our head in the sand on this, or do we want to take a better approach? And I think really beginning with the leagues, there has been an interest in taking a better approach. It was NBA Commissioner Adam Silver who several years ago came out and called for a regulated market. It's Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred who has mentioned at various points in time that the law may be outdated and it needs a fresh look. Even the NFL has said, let's take a fresh look here. Combine that with two other things. One, the emergence of daily fantasy sports, which everybody saw for what it was, a substitute for sports betting, just another form of gambling. And two, the increased league interest in Las Vegas. We have the Vegas Golden Knights. We've got the Raiders coming to Las Vegas. There's now a new acceptance for what happens in Las Vegas, a new comfort with sports betting, regulated sports betting. That's something we need to build on, and I'm confident that we can get this law out of the way in the not-too-distant future, have regulated sports betting across the United States.
Do you think that will be I know I'm asking you to, you know, predict the future, but do you think we'll end up with a national sports betting laws, or do you think it'll end up going state by state?
I think that the likelihood of some type of national federalized system is quite low. We have, for better or worse, made our bed when it comes to how we deal with gaming in this country, and we do that on a state-by-state basis, and these states are empowered. Tribal sovereign nations are empowered, and the federal government has largely stayed out of regulating the gaming product. I would expect that to continue when it comes to sports betting. I think the deck is stacked against some type of nationalized system. Not to say that there wouldn't be some benefits that come with the consistency that would bring, but I expect this to go on a state-by-state basis. I think that it's our job to work with the industry, to work with other stakeholders, to create as much commonality as we can across state lines. That commonality will decrease the inefficiencies in the business and improve the customer experience. So that's what we're focused on. And you already see it now. You've seen upwards of 20 states introduce or pass sports betting legislation. A lot of them, as we wait for the Supreme Court here to rule on the constitutionality of PASPA, are already figuring out how to regulate, tax, and otherwise manage sports betting in their states. And that's only going to continue.
You know, one of the dangers is that states try to overtax it because they could really sort of ruin the game by overtaxing it. Do you and they're not experts on these things, so they don't realize that they could ruin it in that way. Do you get in and advocate in that regard? Try to explain to them that how to structure their taxing of this?
Well, not to your question. Not only could they ruin the game from the customer experience, they could embolden the illegal market, and that's what bad policy does. The customer has options here. They can do what they've been doing now for 20-some years and go into the illegal market, which all things considered is functioning reasonably well for them, or they can come into a well-run legal market. And if our hands get tied to run the legal market correctly, we know where that's going to drive the customer. So do we get involved? Absolutely. We're involved in educating the state legislators and other policymakers as to how the market works, helping them understand that of the $100 that's wagered on sports, only about 5% of that comes back to the industry in any form of profit. And then when you take expenses out of that, you're down to a very meager amount that is true profit for these companies. So helping them understand that is critical. You've already had bad policy adopted, for example, in the state of Pennsylvania, where they have a tax rate of upwards of 36% on sports betting. Simply put, that tax rate is unfeasible. A legal operator cannot succeed in that market, and Pennsylvania has done nothing but adopt sports betting in name only. So it's critical that we help them see how this business works in terms of the how the money moves, in terms of how data is collected, in terms of how integrity is protected of both the bets as well as the games. We've got a lot of work to do when it comes to education.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit. A couple of years ago, there was at least a conversation about reducing the W2G threshold for slot payouts from $1,200 to $600. Thankfully, that idea appears completely dead. Players would very much like to see that limit raised to $2,000 or higher. Do you see any chance of that happening?
Well, what I would say is never count Washington out when it comes to producing bad ideas, and I'm sure there'll be more in the future. But we all saw that effort from the Internal Revenue Service to not just look at reducing the slot tax threshold from $1,200 to $600. They were also looking at using your loyalty marketing card as a mechanism for tracking your play and other things you might do in the casino. We work closely, the commercial industry, the tribal industry, the horse racing industry, and others, to educate the government as to the weaknesses of their proposal, as to the limitations for the casino when it actually comes to tracking play, and as to the unintended consequences of lowering the slot tax threshold. I'm pleased that we were able to prevent that bad idea from coming to fruition, and I'm more excited. In fact, I'm not worried about a decrease from 1,200 to 600. I'm more excited about increasing the slot tax threshold, and that's something we're working on with other elements of the gaming industry. It's common sense. You know, when you adjust the slot tax threshold for inflation from when this thing was set in the late 1970s, the threshold should be nearing $5,000 at this point. So there's no doubt here that we need to increase this. We're talking with a host of stakeholders that could be helpful, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. You know, we have a lot of policies in federal code that use arbitrary numbers set decades ago that have unintended consequences because of how antiquated those numbers are. We need to look at across the government, increasing these things, adjusting for inflation, and giving the business, giving the customer, in whatever instance it might be, a better experience. So we're optimistic. This was discussed briefly in terms of recent tax reform. We raised this issue. Weren't able to get included in the tax reform effort, but we will continue to charge up this hill, and I'm confident that in the future we will be able to increase that threshold.
Good. It almost sounds like Washington's not in gridlock when listening to you. This is good.
Actually, in a similar vein, I'm just curious if this is something you guys have considered at all. Jeff Sessions, there was a move by the Obama administration to curb asset seizures. And Jeff Sessions now wants to increase it again. And certainly for the casino industry, there are a lot of players that play with cash, and it's bad for them if the police and whatnot are out confiscating people's cash. Is that an issue that's ever come up for you guys, or is that just something you stay away from?
It is one that we've dealt with around the margins. I think we were all familiar with what happened in the Obama administration, what's happening here. It's not an issue. Obviously, it's targeting casino customers, but it's one that many Americans are concerned about, and the role of government is certainly one that is raised on this issue. So we look at it, and we're looking at ways to be engaged. It is not a primary concern day-to-day. But it is something that we've certainly had conversations with folks in government about. We've helped them understand how this could affect our customers, what some of the various concerns our customers have may be. You know, I will say that there is there's oftentimes a misunderstanding of our customers, of people that may have thousands of dollars in cash on their person. Who are these people, and why do they behave in this way? I think there's a misunderstanding in some instances, and what we can do is bring greater clarity about our customer, about why they behave the way they behave, and that's something we engage in quite frequently.
Yeah, well, that's great.
All right. And early when we were talking about what you do, you were saying that tribal casinos are part of the AGA, and I guess this was news to me in preparing for this talk. I thought the AGA was almost entirely commercial casinos and not including tribal casinos. So is this a change, or was it just my ignorance along the way?
When the AGA was created, it was basically exclusive to commercial casinos. The AGA was created in the mid-1990s, and I think we would all agree the industry has changed quite considerably from the mid-1990s. When the AGA was created, we were also pretty much a Vegas-centric organization. Today, we are an organization that represents an industry with nearly 1,000 casinos across 40 states, $240 billion in economic activity, 1.7 million jobs created and supported by this industry. We can't effectively represent the industry, in my opinion, if we're Nevada-centric or if we exclude what has become about 50% of all revenue in gaming, and that's coming from the tribal side. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that commercial and tribal agree on everything, but they do agree on lifting the slot tax threshold. They do agree when it comes to getting the government out of the way on issues like sports betting or other issues where the federal government is overstepping its bounds. They do agree on a host of issues that confront the customer and confront the industry. So I'm of the opinion that we are better off working together, finding areas of common cause, and pushing up the mountain together. We're going to be stronger. In that sense, that's been a big focus of AGA. We've had victories because of it. I mentioned our efforts, our effective efforts to stop the federal government from lowering that slot tax threshold. We dealt with similar things when it came to anti-money laundering compliance, where there were misunderstandings in government as to how our industry takes that responsibility very seriously. So, again, there are going to be battles between tribal and commercial. There are going to be battles between commercial and commercial. That's part of business. Our job is to represent the industry, and by all accounts, tribes are a part of this industry, commercials are a part of this industry, and we can find things to work on together.
What percentage of the tribal casino industry is within the AGA today?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. We only represent about 10 or 12 tribes. Now, those 10 or 12 tribes account for a significant portion of the revenue in tribal gaming, upwards of a third of all tribal gaming revenue. We represent the Seminole operation in Florida, the major Oklahoma tribes, the Connecticut tribes, several of the California tribes. So these are big players. They have a lot in common with commercial companies. Most of them are looking at international operations, not just operations here in the United States. So these have become, again, very, very big players. They have many of the same concerns. And, you know, one of the things that struck me when I took this job and I talked to various people about the gaming industry, I would ask them, do you draw any distinction, if you're going to a casino between a tribal casino and a commercial casino? And the answer, invariably, the answer was a casino is a casino. And if the customer, if the policymaker isn't drawing a distinction between commercial and tribal, we're going to be swimming upstream if we're trying to draw a distinction between the two. There are some fundamental differences, but there are many, many more things, again, that we have in common, and I'm pleased to see that we're able to tackle some of those things together.
And I'm pretty sure a lot of the players who listen to this show do make the distinction, and the laws are quite a bit different, and they're enforced differently. So,
I'd be interested in hearing from your listeners and your customers as to, and of course there are laws and regulations that are different, but I'd be interested in hearing if those distinctions are things that affect their experience in a negative way, in a positive way. What are some of the things that we should be trying to replicate from one segment of the industry to the other? That to me is some of the questions we should be asking, and the roads will go down to create more of a streamlined experience.
Yeah, well, the main thing is that you have no civil rights in a tribal casino, and they can, you know, detain you, and they can steal your money, and pretty much they can do whatever they want and have done, you know, to some of our listeners, and you have no recourse because they're a sovereign nation. So if they just lock you up, hold you, handcuff you, take your money, too bad.
That's fascinating. I haven't heard of that. Doesn't sound like such a little thing, but I am not familiar with that.
One of our frequent guests is an attorney, Bob Nersessian, who has written about a book on gambling and the law. That's not the title. That's Nelson Rose's book. But anyway, I'd highly recommend it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Very good. I will send you a reference to that book offline. And one of the things on
Thank you.
Chapter on Indian gaming is, Indian gaming has a license to steal. It's just that simple. It's kind of like the first sentence in that chapter, and which represents kind of the way strong players feel about it. So I'd be very happy to bring you into that conversation.
So I appreciate it, and I'll look to learn more about it. The one point I would make, however, is there's no denying that Indian gaming did upwards of $30 billion in revenue last year. When you look at some of these major players in California, Florida, and Oklahoma, and elsewhere, these companies are often operating consistently with commercial entities. There's a lot in common there. There's no doubt there's difference in the history of how these products were created. There's difference in how they're regulated and how government treats them. I'm of the opinion that focusing on differences, and that's not to say you haven't raised some serious issues here, but focusing on differences is time taken from focusing on what we can do to grow each other's business, and that's the path we've chosen to follow.
Thank you. Good. All right. We're talking to Jeff Freeman, President and CEO of the American Gaming Association. We're going to take a brief commercial break. We'll be back with Jeff with several more questions. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In March, the monthly promotion is geared towards players who are already receiving a mailer. Rather than picking up your usual free play from Tuesday through Thursday, now, in March, whenever you pick up your normal free play Monday through Wednesday, you get the same amount of free play on Friday or Saturday of the same week. If you pick up the free play in all 8 periods in March, you receive a twice the normal amount of your regular free play on Monday, April 2nd. The 9th week of free video poker classes this semester on Tuesday, March 6th, beginning at noon in the Silverado Lounge, is Deuces Bonus Poker. Deuces Bonus Poker is a 99.45% game where you get higher returns for 5 of a kind compared to regular Deuces Wild, but only receive half as much for straights. Classes are free. If you're at least 21 years of age, you're invited. The Silverado Lounge is the first one you come to when you reach the casino from the parking garage elevators. At videopoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Hot Roll Poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where periodically a pair of fair virtual dice are rolled. Whatever the sum of the two dice, from 2 to 12, is used as a multiplier. The multiplier is neutral, meaning the hot roll feature neither adds nor subtracts from the EV of the base game, and the strategy used on the game is identical to what it would be without the hot roll feature. It does allow you to double the stakes. It is a bit slower than regular video poker because of the graphic effects of the rolling dice. All right. We are talking to Jeff Freeman from the American Gaming Association. In early October, there was this mass shooting in Vegas. And casino security and elsewhere, there's a lot of changes in the way things are being done. One example is hotel rooms with Do Not Disturb signs on them are being checked more frequently than before. Is this being discussed among the AGA, or is this just each casino coming up with their own way of doing things?
First of all, it was coincidental, but my entire team, we were in Las Vegas when this event took place. We're based in Washington, but we were all in Las Vegas for Global Gaming Expo, G2E, that was starting up the next day. The entire industry had gathered for G2E, more than 30,000 attendees had come to that show. It was a testing time, a humbling time across the industry. I'm grateful that we were together at that time, because I think it brought out the best in the industry, and it gave us a time to be together to begin to talk about some of these issues about safety and security. I say begin. It wasn't the beginning by any means. We have a standing surveillance and security working group that talks about these issues regularly, but it gave us an opportunity to dig in on this specific issue and what we need to do together. Those conversations have continued, but they're not exclusive to the gaming industry. When you look at what happened in Las Vegas, it's a situation that could have happened in many other markets. Indeed, the shooter was looking at other markets to do his harm. And it certainly is not unique to casinos. It could happen in hotel properties anywhere. So we've worked with the American Hotel and Lodging Association, with their security and surveillance working group, to combine our teams, to talk about best practices, to learn from one another, and that effort is ongoing. Each property is adopting policies specific to their unique situations. It's not something that they or we talk about publicly, but I can assure you that there is more dialogue going on now than there has been at any point in time, and we're pleased to be a hub for those discussions.
Yes. Sad subject to talk about, and it's an important subject. Where does your crystal ball tell you the casino expansion in the United States will be taking place in the next 5 years?
You know, when you look at expansion, as I mentioned before, we have casinos in 40 states at this point. So just by that standard alone, there really isn't a ton of room for geographic expansion. Of course, there is the possibility in states like Georgia, which has been talking about this, the state of Texas, which frequently talks about this. And I think, quite frankly, that all of these states will come online sooner or later, perhaps with the exception of Utah. I think all of these states will be coming online sooner than later, because when you look at the facts associated with the industry, the communities in which we do business are quite proud to have casinos in their presence. They can speak to the economic impact. They can speak to the jobs impact. They can speak to the social value of the industry. So I do believe that as that story is heard, expansion becomes easier. When I look out over the next 5 years, however, less of a focus on geographic expansion and more of a focus on expansion through public policy. And what I mean by that is that as casinos expanded beyond the state of Nevada and the state of New Jersey, you often saw the industry come into these markets, but with terrible policy complementing the industry. Tax rates upwards of 60%, enormous restrictions when it came to the shipping of machines and other things that create extraordinary inefficiencies in the process. I think our opportunity to grow as an industry, to create more money available for innovation and reinvestment is to address some of these faulty policies that the industry is dealing with, policies that assume that the industry was a monopoly that will come in and cause social harm. Those policies are very much the wrong policies when it comes to growth and innovation. And as we change those, I think the customer experience will improve. I'll give you one example of that. You know, the state of Maryland had a debate not too long ago about how close ATMs should be to slot machines. The state said no closer than 15 feet. The industry said, well, how about 7 feet? And we compromised at 11 feet. Now, I don't know what the heck 11 feet has to do, 15 feet or 7 feet has to do with responsible gaming, helping the customer, or improving the experience. I know that, quite frankly, it's cynical policy. And if we can change that, if we can give the customer a better experience, perhaps we move to a cashless environment for those customers that are interested. That's how we expand and grow as an industry, and that's the opportunity we have in front of us.
Do you see the industry anywhere near saturated in this country? It's not a young industry.
It's a highly competitive industry, and the industry can be defined differently. We are an industry that is appealing for limited discretionary dollars. You know, our customers have choices. They can go to the casino. They can go see a show. They can go to a ball game. They've got multiple options, and we are competing with those other products for limited discretionary dollars, which is why we have to give people the best experience we possibly can. You know, I often stay up at Mandalay Bay, and we all saw in Nevada the incredible renovations that has taken place at Mandalay Bay over recent years, as it has at every casino on the Strip. But one example is how they ripped out every restaurant that was in there. They changed the hotel into the Delano. They basically gave the entire property a facelift. That's because the customer is always demanding a new experience, and you can do that in a market like Nevada with a 7.5% tax rate. But how do you do that in a market where you have a 55% tax rate, a 60% tax rate? Our customer is looking for an entertainment experience that is constantly reinventing itself. And one of the things that concerns me are things that limit our ability to reinvent.
Okay. Moving on. Does the American Gaming Association still keep a neutral view on online gaming, given that you had valued members on both sides of the debate?
Well, it's an area where we have constant discussion. When I joined the AGA in 2013, there was a push for a federal poker-only solution when it came to online gaming, and that was a position that not only did it not unite all of our industry, there were opponents and proponents. What it did was leave a lot of our industry sitting in the middle in somewhat of a non-interested, uninterested fashion. So there's no doubt we have work to do when it comes to aligning the industry on the future of the industry, to what technology means for the industry, and we're having those discussions on a regular basis in a private fashion. Sports betting, to me, is a great example of what can happen when we have those discussions in an effective way. We learn from one another. We take the time to work through our differences. We're now at a point where we support collectively as an industry an expansion of sports betting, and we support doing it in a way that's done in Nevada, which includes intrastate mobile sports betting. So that's what you can get to when you have the right process, when you do the diligence you need to do on these issues. And we'll continue to look at the issue of online gaming. We'll look at the issue of esports. We'll look at the everything coming down the pike to figure out where we can find common cause and what we can focus on.
I was actually surprised that sports betting has moved faster than online poker. I mean, I really expected online poker to sort of have taken off a little faster. What has stalled that?
When you say taken off, you mean taken off politically?
Well, I expected California to have online poker by now. I expected it to be expanding. You know, 4 years ago, if you had said, I think we'll have legal sports betting before we have online poker, that would have shocked me. But that looks like it's going to be the case.
Well, here's why I would argue that it is very obvious why sports betting would take off more quickly. when you look at, in retrospect, it's obvious, when you look at poker, when you look at casino-style games, the proponents of expanding these things, the stakeholders involved, were the casino industry and fill in the blank. It's hard to figure out who else was a real champion of seeing that expansion. Yes, states stood the opportunity to gain greater revenue, but we didn't, and proponents of broader expansion didn't succeed in bringing other stakeholders to the table. Now flip over to sports betting and look at what's happened there. You have leagues stepping forward and saying it's time to regulate. You have broadcasters who have the opportunity to make significant sums and attract new eyeballs to their television or other streaming entities. You have advertisers who are always looking for more eyeballs. You have the law enforcement community who is sick and tired of trying to enforce antiquated sports betting laws and would rather see these things taken off the book. And you have the gaming industry. You know, when you look at that in totality, I think it makes sense because the interest here is so much broader than the gaming industry. And an important lesson for us is it's important that we bring other stakeholders to the table. When we do that, we can succeed. And I think that's a fundamental difference between sports betting and online casino style and poker games.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Millennials, skill-based gaming. Where do you see all that going?
The word that everybody's sick and tired of hearing, right? Millennials. It's one that our industry is obviously talking about, obviously trying to figure out what the next generation is interested in. I think the key from our perspective is, and this goes back to our point before about antiquated public policy, the key from our perspective is that the industry has the freedom to try different things. The industry has the freedom to engage in trial and error. We don't know exactly what's going to work for the next generation of customers. We don't know where skill-based slot machines fit in. We don't know where esports fits in. We don't know where mobile, in-game sports betting fits in. The key is that we have the ability, like any other business, to engage in a degree of trial and error, and that's where we need a partnership with regulators to enable that to happen. An area where, quite frankly, tribal entities have a little bit more freedom to try new products. So I would just say that it's something we need to consider. I don't think any of these things are a silver bullet. I don't think that any of them are going to remake the casino industry. But nor do I think we need to. I think we need to constantly improve around the margins, and some of these products may be helpful in doing that.
Esports seems to be the thing. The other thing that just the word that gets used as often as millennials. Everybody seems to want to get into the esports business. But
sure.
But, yeah, I think you're right.
For two reasons. It targets a customer that is not a typical casino customer. When you look at the esports customer, somewhere in that 20 to 40 range, a lot of them not a typical casino customer. And number two, the amount of dollars being spent. The amount that is spent to, you know, whether it's these loot boxes or what people pay to access different weapons or materials is a lot of money, and then increasingly the amount that people are spending via these betting channels on who's going to win or who's going to lose. Now, there's enormous questions from a regulatory standpoint, from an underage standpoint, and a lot of things we've got to get our arms around, but the casino gaming industry should always be on the front lines of some of these new developments, and I think we should have the courage to fail. We should have the courage to try new things, and that's not a bad thing. That's how we reinvent this industry. One out of every 10 things is going to work.
Yeah, also the customer base. I mean, there are millions and millions of people playing these video games, so
agreed.
If they could tap into it and find a way to monetize it, yeah, it'd be a big thing.
Agreed.
All right, Jeff Freeman. We are going to let you go. We very much appreciate the time that you spent with us. We will get you an email as to the reference to the citation on that book. Thank you for discussing it with us, and hope to have you back again in the future. And Richard and I are going to stick around and answer some more questions, but Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right. We are a shorter show, so we still have some listener questions that we haven't quite gotten to yet. So these are going to be riffing, where we're kind of off the top of our head. And so since Richard's better than that, I'm going to give him more of the questions. Ha, ha, ha. Okay. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready. Fire when loaded.
All right. What would you recommend as a proper time to end a blackjack session? Either a time limit or amount won or lost.
Right. Well, this came in the mail the other day, and I would highly recommend you go back and listen to a lot of the old shows because this is a topic that comes up quite often. So the answer is it has to do with how much you've won or lost, but not for the reason that you think. As long as you feel that you are playing to the best of your ability, that you're not making any mistakes, then when you quit has nothing to do with the amount you've won or lost other than how it affects the casino. When you win a certain amount of money, the casino is going to start to react, and every casino, that's different. You know, if you're playing at the Gold Coast, it's, you know, $50 or something, but if you're playing at Mandalay Bay, it might be $10,000. So you have to make a judgment about when you think you're pushing the limit of what they can stomach. Also, if you're counting cards, after a certain amount of time, somebody's just going to take a look at you because your bets have to go up and down to have an edge. And the longer you stay, the more likely they are to look at how you're playing and then throw you out. So, yeah, there's no hard and fast answer. There's no rule that you can live by here. You're just going to have to make judgment calls. But again, don't base it on, oh, I'm just unlucky today or something like that.
I want to talk about how that works in video poker because some of what he said is right for video poker, but there's some differences too. In video poker, you are frequently playing with some promotion, whether it is a point multiplier or it is earn so many points and you get an entry into blah, 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 or something that there's some natural stopping points. If triple points ends at midnight, you don't really probably want to be playing at 1 a.m. Or so in blackjack, that's normally not true. You're normally not playing for the promotions. But in video poker, promotions are a part of it. And so the promotions themselves give some natural endings. Also in video poker, one way we do things today is we give our ID because of the W2Gs, and we get mailers, slot clubs. And so there are, after a while, you get an idea. If you play $10,000 a month, you get this benefit package, or $100,000 a month, or $1 million a month, or whatever the number is, and you get the benefit package that you're looking for, including the $10,000 a month might get a $5 mailer, and the $1 million a month might get a $1,000 mailer. But so when you exceed what it is that your goal was, that might be a time to consider leaving. But again, it has nothing to do with whether you're ahead or behind.
Yeah, another practical consideration is the CTR threshold. So if you're trying to play anonymously, you can't get in $10,000 or they're going to have to file a CTR, which means they're going to have to require you to give them ID and your social security number. You know, I always have some cushion there because I don't believe they can count accurately. So, you know, if I get stuck 9,000, I'm probably going to leave.
Different subject. A player was playing and the dealer made a mistake. And another player pointed out that mistake to the dealer.
Yeah, I hate those people.
It hurt the particular player who's writing us the email. So when
it always happens when I'm betting 500 and the guy pointing out the mistake is betting $5.
Or it's even his wife sitting next to him. She's not even in the hand.
Right.
So what do you do?
You know, I usually tell them to shut up. I mean, this is why I try to get rid of people off a table I'm playing on. I really don't want to be playing with civilians. That's just one of the many reasons. You know, unfortunately, there's not much you can do. You know, the guy's going to say what he's going to say. You know, I make it very clear that I'm very unhappy that he's saying it. And if I can find a way to get him off the table, I will.
Uh-huh. So you might bring out a cigar or something if you think that's what it'll take.
Yeah.
All right, different subject. There was somebody wrote that Richard says he doesn't make any cover plays in blackjack other than not splitting tens. So he wants you to clarify, does that mean betting strictly accordance to the count, raise after a push, raise after a loss, raise by more than a full parlay, etc.?
Well, so this is specifically talking about counting cards, where your edge is very small. If I'm playing some form of blackjack where the edge is much larger, then I definitely would make cover plays. So an obvious example is you see the dealer's hole card, and he has 20 and you have 19, I'm not going to hit. You know, he has a 10 up and a 2 in the hole or a 6 in the hole, I'm probably not going to stand on 12, even though, it's the right play. So, but when counting cards, I haven't counted cards in a long time just because it has the smallest edge and the most amount of heat. So it's just not something I do. You know, if I were to go count cards, I think my attitude would be kind of more bonsai, and I would, probably back count and just come in with my whatever my max bet is. So I'm only flat betting, and I'm not going to make cover plays like not hitting 12 against a 2 or something like that, because I think it'll fool them. Yeah, I guess that's my answer.
All right, we have another question. Somebody usually plays blackjack where the dealer hits on soft 17, but occasionally plays a game where the dealer stands on soft 17. So his question is, are the differences in basic strategy big enough that he's really got to go through a whole effort to learn the difference, even though he only plays one of them really, really rarely?
Well, there's only five, I think, right? So how hard is it to learn the five differences? And I would learn them. For those of us who started when the game was all single deck, you know, we had to learn things like that it was basic strategy to double down with a total of 5-3, a total of 8, but not with a total of 6-2. You know, I mean, so, yeah, I just don't think it's that hard. It's sort of like a surrender, right? I mean, there are only a few surrender basic strategy plays. How hard is it to learn them? So yeah, I would say learn them.
Yeah, if you can't learn them, then your mind's not in the right place to really be doing this anyway. All right. We have run out of extra listener questions, and we had a good interview with Jeff Freeman. So we're still a little bit short, and that means we're going to end a little bit short today.
That's the good thing about not having to fill an hour on radio, is that we can make these any length we want.
Yes, it is a nice feature. So thank you, Richard, and go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.